petitioners in 1464-8 Limited versus Joplin.
May I please report, Mr. Robert Gilbert, representing our petitioner. Petitioner number 0526.
Good morning. May I please report? It is our position that when an option contract contains a recital of nominal consideration, say a dollar or $10, the nominal consideration need not actually be paid to make the option enforceable.
Just an option contract or any contract?
The restatement has a section, Your Honor, called Contracts Without Consideration, in which it addresses option contracts, guarantees, and certain other situations. Of course, our case, we would say that the court need only make the decision with respect to option contracts, but there certainly would be some merit, according to many scholars, of reconsidering the whole scheme of bargain for the bargain theory of consideration, which gives rise to these situations where you have these recitals of nominal consideration. But at this point, for purposes of our case, we would ask that the court adopt this approach simply for option agreements.
Define nominal.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Define nominal.
That's under the bargain theory of consideration. Nominal consideration would be, I mean, in most instances, it's a dollar or $10, but it really depends on whether the parties did they bargain for the amount of money that's recited. And in most instances, it ends up being a dollar or $10. But the real question is, was there a bargain? Were promises exchanged? Was the promise exchanged in return for this amount of money? If it wasn't, then it's nominal consideration. What the treatises say is nominal consideration is consideration, another term for it is sham consideration, where it's not actually paid. Consideration that's just small in amount is somewhat distinguishable.
Well, the restatement also talks about different amounts being nominal depending on the length of the option and the amount at stake.
Yes.
It talks about a 120-day nominal consideration recital requirement on lien. I think there's another example about a 10-year option period where it indicates that a certain so-called nominal amount would not be sufficient.
Yes.
What guidance would you give us on what nominal should be, or is it just up to us to pick a sliding scale?
I think what we're going to advocate today, Your Honor, is that you do away with the requirement of a recital of nominal consideration altogether, which is what the position is advocated in the Court of Contracts by Professor Carrillo, who says, you know, those types of charades should not be part of a mature legal system, so that you wouldn't need this recital of nominal consideration. But your point goes to the fairness of the transaction, Your Honor, and the restatement says, look, we're going to do away with the consideration requirement, but we are still going to require that the transaction be on fair terms. And so what Professor Farnsworth says is that what we're looking to do here is to prevent excessive speculation at the expense of the promisor, so that the promisee doesn't have this opportunity to take advantage of the promisor. Say, you know, if I have the right to repurchase this land for $50,000 and I can exercise that 10 years in the future when the land value has increased manifold, that would not be a fair transaction. The restatement says you can't have it, you can't have this rule apply unless it's a fair transaction.
I'm not sure I followed the specifics of your guidance. I think as your suggested guidance. Initially, you said that as long as it's bargained for, that should be sufficient. Then you talked about a fairness element coming into play. Let me ask, if the contract recites X dollars, whatever that number might be, and the parties know it's there, there's no fraud, there's no other theory of defense established to invalidate the contract, is that sufficient to constitute your, so long as it's bargained for, it should be acknowledged by the court?
Yes, Your Honor, under the restatement.
Okay, and thanks for that short answer. And then the fairness consideration you're talking about, should we wait on the parties or require that the parties have raised an unconscionability or a lack of, or a fraud or a collusion defense before we delve into fairness?
Yes,
you're saying that should be one of the things we look at on the front end.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, when the bargain theory of consideration came about, it evolved in the late 19th century. One of the things that had to be done was to devise other ways of making sure that a transaction was fair. Because under the bargain theory, as the court well knows, a peppercorn would be sufficient as long as the parties bargained for it. But other doctrines had to be developed to make sure that the transaction was fair. Doctrines of mistake, capacity, fraud, duress. And so if a party brings those issues up and says, well, I was tricked into this, and then yes, the court should look into that.
So going back to your example, if there's an option contract and the contract says for $50,000 in hand paid, receipt of which is acknowledged and confessed, the option period is 2 years. At the end of that, there's an attempt to exercise it, but the $50,000 was never paid, and no defensive theories are raised, then that should be enforced. The option contract should be enforced.
Yes, because the option the option is simply an irrevocable.
Let me clarify that. The only defense raised is the $50,000 wasn't paid, but no fraud, no collusion.
Yes, Your Honor, because if we get to exercise the option, we'll pay the promisor for the land. And so there will be an exchange of consideration at that time. And that's why the restatement says, look, these things are ancillary. These option agreements are ancillary to bargain transactions.
Let me ask you this. I mean, you'd have to admit that there hasn't been necessarily a lot of jumping onto the restatement train. Why do you think that is?
I think because the issue doesn't come up that often, Your Honor. I think this is such a formality and a technicality that it's rarely raised. We've looked, of course, for cases, and we found, I don't think we found any cases that said we reject the restatement position other than the one Idaho case, I believe it was, that we cite in our
brief.
But
nor have you found any that have adopted it. Most have continued to follow the other approach.
That's right. We have cited some federal cases where the courts have cited it and followed that approach, but they haven't really discussed it. So I think the reason is this issue just doesn't come up that often. And I think as Professor Farnsworth says, there's a problem with, in the legal system, we're very complacent about the doctrine of consideration, and we've grown accustomed to it. It's really difficult to come up with an alternative to the bargain theory of consideration. And so courts have remained wedded to some of these antiquated rules that, frankly, the business community, every business person I've talked to about this case scoffs at the notion that this exchange of nominal consideration has anything to do with the bargain or what's going on in the transaction. And frankly, I think that it invites disrespect for the law for the courts to enforce this requirement because in the real world where these transactions are taking place, people are saying, well, we've got to have this recital in here because I guess the law requires it.
If we adopt the position you want, part and parcel of not honoring this is to say it's not necessary.
That's
right. It would be even stupider to say you have to put it in there, but we're not going to enforce it. If it's not, unless there's some proof you really wanted that $10.
That's right, Your Honor. I think the court should go farther than a restatement. I mean, Professor Perillo in Corbin on Contract says a restatement is great, but they don't go far enough because of this recital requirement. It's a charade, and a mature legal system should not have that. What the restatement accomplishes without the recital is the formality that brings home to the parties what they're doing. They're agreeing to be bound by this transaction. I mean, legal formalities perform two functions. First, they perform an evidentiary function, the writing requirement, so you can see what the terms, and you can see that the contract exists, you can see what the terms are. And they perform a cautionary function, which is they bring home to the parties the significance of what they're doing. I'm entering into a binding contract. In the past, the seal served that purpose of the cautionary formality. Over time, it became the formality of the seal eroded so that you could just adopt a seal on a piece of paper. Your signature could suffice as a seal. So we abolished the seal because it was no longer performing a cautionary formality. Consideration, as many of the scholars say, well, we ought to do away with the doctrine of consideration for the same reasons. I mean, Oliver Wendell Holmes at the turn of the century said, look, consideration is as much a form as is a seal. And Lord Mansfield said in 1765, he gave birth to the idea that the formality of putting a promise in writing should operate as an alternative to consideration. And that's what the restatement requires, is put it in writing, you sign it. That should be sufficient to
serve. I suppose there would be times, though, when you would want to be clear what the consideration was, so that you would, so there wouldn't be an argument later on that something else was really the consideration, or in a failure situation, you wouldn't know exactly what had failed. Is that true, or what do you?
I think the restatement says, Your Honor, let's do away with the consideration requirement altogether. I mean, it's in a section called Contracts Without Consideration. There is no consideration requirement for the option. The reason being is because it's just the first step in a transaction where you're going to have an exchange of consideration. A margin transaction where, for example, in our case, we exercise the option, we pay her 90% of the purchase price. Well, that was a bargain that took place in the context of the sale of the land.
Well, but the option could have a significant value, right? I mean, there could be occasions where nominal consideration is not enough. The parties might negotiate, you know, I mean, it's just worth a lot to have that very option. And in that case, you wouldn't do away with consideration. Is that right? Or?
Well, you would have other doctrines to ensure the fairness of the transaction. I mean, the doctrine of consideration is primarily developed to protect promisors from their own donative promises. And so if you've got a transaction taking place in the marketplace, you're not going to have, I mean, a bargain is an inevitable ingredient of a transaction that takes place in the marketplace. So you're not going to have a situation where the promisor is making a donative promise. And so under the bargain theory of consideration, we don't look at the sufficiency of the consideration. We don't look at market equivalence. So under those circumstances, if it takes place in the marketplace, there's no other reason to believe the transaction was unfair, then let's enforce it.
And is that due to our employment at will cases?
Under employment at will cases? I'm not sure how that would arise, Your Honor. Let's see.
Well, you said that you want to do away with consideration entirely is what I heard.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. In this situation with option agreements, yes. There certainly is some merit, and many scholars would advocate that the court look at the possibility of changing or at least restricting the doctrine of consideration in all contracts. And that's the theory Professors Matheson and Farber, I believe, have this theory that...
How many states have done that?
Probably none, Your Honor.
It's cutting edge.
It certainly would be.
Let me ask you this. Was the purchase price, just curious, $99,000 as stated in the written words or $58,500 as stated in the parentheses?
In the option. In the option, it would be 90% of the purchase price. So I think.
The option says two different prices in it. I was just wondering.
I think we would concede that it would be the higher of the two.
Okay.
Why doesn't estoppel work in this situation where it's recited in the option contract that it is hereby acknowledged to be sufficient and receipt is hereby acknowledged? Why does estoppel take care of that?
I think it's certain the courts have used that theory. I think it's Professor Perillo and Corbin. So that's sort of a legal sleight of hand that courts have used because they're scared to get away from the doctrine of consideration. And the restatement just says, just do away with the doctrine of consideration. But certainly, that theory has been used, and it would work in this case.
And it's been raised and argued in this case, right?
Yes.
I saw it in the responsive brief.
Yes.
Argued in some length.
Yes, we certainly would take that position. We also take the position that, you know, if the court is unwilling to reach this issue of whether we should adopt the restatement, the court may reverse the Court of Appeals judgment on the simple notion that there was consideration for this transaction. It was the exchange of the land.
We get into that, let me ask you a question. Isn't there a statute that requires that option contracts be in writing? It may be in the UCC.
Yes.
You have a chance to pull it.
Yes.
So you may argue it only applies to goods.
Yes.
Does it apply generally, though?
No, it's in the UCC 2-205 under
goods and services.
Firm offers.
So it doesn't apply here. It
does not apply here. I would call the court's attention to one case that's not cited in our brief, and we've provided a copy to Mr. Mathern, but it is 644 Southwest 2nd, 185, U.S. Life Title Company of Dallas versus Andreen, from the San Antonio Court of Appeals, Justice Butts, who has written this decision and another one that's I can't remember right now, but she's taken
very... Anybody have a question about that case?
Oh, I'm sorry. My time is up.
Another question about the statute in the UCC. Does it say anything about this consideration issue? I haven't looked at it in some time.
The UCC,
anything
no.
That might be analogous in our situation?
The UCC just says if it's a merchant and it's in writing, it's a firm offer and it will be enforceable.
Can you tell me real quick what the San Antonio Court of Appeals says?
In that case, that case supports our argument that the land itself, the exchange of the land, was consideration for the option agreement. And that case was a very similar set of facts, and the court said, let's just look at this thing in the overall context.
Were they signed the same day in that case?
They were signed the same day. One was signed in the bank, and then they went out into the parking lot and signed a right of repurchase, the parties did. And so they weren't signed simultaneously. And the court goes into the notion of, well, you've got to look at these documents together. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from response.
May it please the court, Mr.
GP,
the third will present argument for the response.
May it please the court. Justice Walker, speaking for the court in 1959, the case of Miles v. Martin, acknowledges that separate instruments executed at the same time between the same parties and relating to the same subject matter may be considered together and construed as one contract. He also acknowledges that there are decisions that will be found where instruments have been construed together or treated as one instrument if they're not even between the same parties. He also says it's a sound principle, but we have to look to the intention of the parties before we use it. What were the intentions of the parties here? Two separate contracts, a deed and an option. The option could have been retained, reserved in that deed, just like you reserve minerals.
So when she signed it under oath, she didn't mean it?
I beg your pardon?
So when she signed it under oath, she didn't mean it because it was out in the parking lot? The option agreement signed by your client under oath, right?
Right, but what I'm saying is, no, it's not under oath.
So let's assume it's a separate contract. Why does that make it invalid?
I didn't say it was invalid. I said it shouldn't be construed together. It's two separate transactions. The deed transfers the property to the respondent, and then the other document gives the petitioner the right to repurchase the property for a lesser value than it was paid. Okay, so I'm saying that in this case, we have two separate documents, two separate instruments. They should not be construed together.
Well, what about the language in the option contract that says, and other good and valuable considerations?
It does not say that, Your Honor. It only says $10. And if you look at the deed, it says the same exact language. Now, if it had other good and valuable consideration, then we could have explained what it was. But there's no language in the deed or the option agreement that says other good and valuable consideration. It says $10. It had paid. This principle that I just discussed, filed an application in Jones v. Kelly, a 1981 case where two earnest money contracts were used and construed together to satisfy the statute of frauds. In Jim Walter Holmes, 1984, it was used to construe various documents together to get unusual interest.
Counsel Dean? Was it agreed beforehand during the sale?
Ma'am?
Was this concept of the ability to buy back absent development within a certain period of time or building within a certain period of time, was that discussed in connection with the sale of the property?
I cannot say yes or no.
Well, it was in the earnest money agreement.
Well, if you look at the earnest money agreement, there's one paragraph.
Well, it's in there.
Right, it is.
Well, how can the answer
be? But it was merged into the deed.
Well, but how can the answer be it wasn't discussed in the negotiations when it was in the earnest money agreement?
Oh, no, I thought you said in the closing.
Well, it was discussed at closing, too, because they signed it.
Well, it may have been, Your Honor. I mean, but that's not the key. The key is when the deed was written, all the negotiations were merged into that deed. Okay? Now, let's assume, if you will, that the option agreement is not there. And let's say we're trying to enforce an option agreement based on the earnest money contract and based upon the deed. The option agreement would not be enforceable. Why? Because it was an agreement to make a contract in the future. And the central terms were not there. If you look at the earnest money contract, the option is one paragraph. If you look at the true option agreement, it's three pages.
Counsel, do you dispute that the parties understood that the developer, 14648 Limited, wanted the land in this subdivision to be developed, not just to sit undeveloped?
Everybody knew that. In the record, Your Honor, said that I don't think I'll be ever executing that. That's neither here nor there for this discussion.
But the parties
had that intention. But that's not the issue here. The issue is, did that $10 not paid offer valid consideration? The first thing we're doing is saying that the two instruments should be construed separately, and they should each be supported by consideration.
Did the developer, is there anything in the record where the developer ever intimated that it wouldn't sell the land unless it was going to be developed?
I don't believe so.
And you don't think the option contract sends that message?
It could have been. It could have been, Your Honor. But all I'm saying is the option contract is not in – I didn't say it was void. I said it's voidable because he didn't pay the consideration.
Here's my question. It's in paragraph D, addendum A.
Ma'am?
There's a section D, paragraph D, in addendum A, the earnest money contract, specifically says that the option agreement shall be executed by the buyer and seller at closing. It specifies the 90% and the 18 months. Let's suppose that at closing, the buyer comes in and has not executed that. Can the seller get specific performance of this provision?
Right, but you need to understand that earnest money contract, due to the merger doctrine, was merged into the deed. So all prior negotiations and everything are merged into that deed.
My question is, at closing, the seller and the buyer show up. Can the seller specifically enforce its specific performance and require the buyer to exercise an option agreement at closing that says this?
I would think so, but I don't know.
And that's what they did.
Right. But if they could. But here again, it's got to be consideration for the document. I'm not saying it's void. I'm saying it's void.
Wasn't the consideration the agreement to convey the property in the first place?
No, ma'am, because it says $10. You cannot expand or alter a written instrument. Now, if it had said other than value consideration, you could have brought in everything.
So we really are just talking about form then, and stamps and wax and things like that. If you're just talking about a few words, then no one is really intending that makes a difference, the $10 or $1 in the nominal context. You're just asking us to maintain this illusion that this language makes a difference, makes
it,
sense.
It does make a difference. And
how?
And
I mean, how does it in the practical world, that $10 was not exchanged on that day?
It could have been avoided two ways. Paid $10.
Yeah, but why does $10 matter, or $1?
It matters because...
What does that add to the transaction?
It adds to this transaction. It performs an essential element to a contract consideration.
So why didn't your client say, hey, where's my
$10? I don't know.
How can your client sign something under oath saying the $10 was in hand? Say something different now. Is she lying now or then?
No, sir. It's nothing more than a receipt, and you can prove by parole evidence whether or not it was given.
In the broadest case, this court said you can't sign a promissory note with the bank, I promise to pay you $50,000, and then come back later and say, actually, they told me I didn't ever have to pay that. No, when you sign a note that says you'll pay $50,000, you can't have a King's X and try to prove that you didn't. Why is this any different? She said she got $10.
Okay, because the Supreme Court of this state says you can dispute it. It's nothing more than a receipt. And Faust is defended.
It's nothing more than a what?
A receipt. And it can be disputed.
Now, this is not a receipt.
You're acknowledging receiving $10. And
so why isn't my promise to pay $50,000 to the bank a receipt or recital?
Well, you can come in and prove that you didn't get it.
No, that's what Broadus says you can't do. Broadus says if I promise to pay the bank $50,000 for the loan, I can't come back and say, no, I never promised that.
But this is not a loan. This is a payment. I pay you $10 for your car. I'm not promising to pay you $10 for your car. I'm saying I gave you $10 for your car. I can say, you can say, I didn't get to $10.
So every contract can be avoided on that basis.
Every contract that recites a receipt of consideration, the receipt can be disputed.
Counsel, would you acknowledge that if, let's say, the option was never exercised and then there was a purchase of the land and the purchase price for the land was never paid, that can be disputed?
Yes, sir.
Even if the deed says, well, it's going to be paid. Has been paid.
Right, because
that can be disputed because it's the consideration of purchase of the race of,
right,
of the property.
The developer saying I received X dollars, and then he can say I can prove that he didn't get it.
Lanier versus Faust, 1891, that you cite.
Right.
In that case, there may be two differences here. You cited for support of your position. Let me ask you about it. In that case, the amount wasn't nominal. It was $100 in 1891. Quarter of the purchase price for 79 acres of land. $100 in 1891 was probably a pretty sizable sum, right?
Right.
So that's probably a difference here. Whether you think it makes a difference, it's at least according to petitioner's position, a big difference.
Well,
the other one is it was purchase price for the actual property, not an amount as consideration for an option.
Well, that's true, but Your Honor, the principle is...
Those two differences you don't think are important.
The difference being that acknowledging that you received X dollars is nothing more than a receipt, and it can't be disputed or explained by parole. Okay? And so that case, I think, is good law today, whether it's $100 for 2 acres back in 1800 or for
18
foot today.
So you think Lanier applies whether it's the purchase price for the property at issue or whether it's for or whether it's a nominal amount for an option?
No, it's being able to dispute whether or not you actually received the money. That's what that stands for.
Okay.
Now, they've cited two cases for the nominal, saying that the nominal consideration doesn't have to be paid. One is for Pennsylvania. Now, the Pennsylvania case, the results have been the same here in Texas. Because they failed to plead failure of consideration.
Well, let's talk about the Texas case. Haven't the courts of appeals held that if consideration is not actually paid, the option contract is revocable?
Yes, ma'am.
Prior to acceptance?
Yes, ma'am.
Why wasn't there acceptance here before it was revoked? My understanding is the option was exercised.
No, ma'am. It was an intent. If you look at the option agreement, it says that he has to exercise the option. He did not exercise the option, and as I stand here today, that option has not been exercised.
It says the option may be exercised upon written notice delivered, and he did that.
No, sir. He says, I intend to exercise this option. If you look at his notice, in other words, the option agreement says, I shall give you notice that I have exercised it. He said, I intend to exercise this option on a date in the future, of 30 days, I think. And so the option was never exercised. If you look at the option agreement, he had to tender the money. That money was never tendered. So as we stand here today, that option has not been exercised.
If we were to find it had been exercised, if we were to find that he had properly exercised the option,
I wouldn't be out of here.
Okay.
Because a gratuitous option is enforceable if it's accepted prior to revocation. I don't have the case here, but I had another case where that principle came into play. In other words, I'll give you an option to buy my land for X dollars, and you exercise it, before I revoke it, it's enforceable. Because I have the right to tell you, to give you anything. So in this case here, the option was not revoked. If he had, the option was not exercised, and if he had exercised it, we would not be here today. So, what they're trying to say, though, in this nominal consideration issue, is that a seal, the mere mention of nominal consideration is equivalent to a seal. Well, we have a very old case where there was a contract for land under seal, but there was no consideration proved, and it was not upheld. So the case that you were talking about, Your Honor, was Hoyt v. Pearson Crist, where it says it can be revoked during its term if there's no consideration. It should also be noted that the Georgia case applies that rule to all real property cases, not just options. So if you have a nominal consideration to sell real property, you're dead in the water in Georgia, whereas that's not true here. He also cited that there's several federal courts that have adopted this particular principle. Well, as a very old Erie Railroad v. Tompkins says, the federal court cannot decide what the common law of Texas is.
Counsel, what do you make of the estoppel argument, the argument that your client signed the option agreement?
There's no pleadings for that, Your Honor.
No pleadings?
No, sir. That was not pled. In our pleadings, we pled all conditions precedent had been performed. They filed a general denial. Even in their petition for specific performance, they did not plead all conditions precedent. They did not prove anything. There was no evidence that they presented in order to be entitled to a summary judgment. No evidence that met the evidence for those muster. So if I pled all conditions precedent, that means that it hadn't been exercised. That's one of the things that they had to deny. They didn't deny it. I had to prove that the money wasn't tendered, and I said all conditions precedent had been performed. That took care of all of those arguments.
Let me take you back to estoppel. If it had been pled, would that be a problem for you?
I didn't brief it, Your Honor, so I cannot discuss it.
Did they mention it?
It was not an issue in this case.
Did they mention it in their motion for summary judgment?
I beg your pardon?
Did they mention it in their motion for summary judgment?
No, I don't think so. There was no evidence presented.
Obviously, if they mentioned it in their motion for summary judgment, it wouldn't matter whether they pled it or not unless you objected, right?
Right, and I don't think they did. But I cannot tell you they did or not as they stand here.
Nor can I. We'll have to look that up.
Pardon?
Nor can I. We'll have to look that up.
Well, I can look it up right away.
That's all I'm
sorry. And so the peppercorn theory that they talk about, saying that nominal consideration is it doesn't have to be paid, that could change Texas law. Because why shouldn't it be applied to all contracts? Why? I mean, we could do away with one rule in the rules of civil procedure, i.e. failure of consideration or want of consideration. So that argument, I think, is fallacious. Also, why can't we consider the option, the earnest money contract, as part of the sale of the property, as part of the sale? Because of the merger doctrine has been well briefed by this board.
Counsel, let me, before you go down that road, you mentioned estoppel, both in connection with Lanier versus Faust, that Supreme Court case you cited. 1891 and in another section, but your position is it's not properly before the court?
No, Your Honor. It's not. ...1967 case, Commercial Bank Incorporated Mason versus Satterwhite, said in the absence of mistake, accident, or fraud, all prior agreements are merged into one document. So all our prior agreements, up until the time that deed was executed, was merged into the agreement. And so,
including the option.
Including the option.
So your position is you can't have a separate option agreement?
No, from Your Honor. You can if it's supported by consideration. For instance, if they'd have said...
Why wouldn't it still be merged in the deed?
Because it was in the earnest money contract. That's where it came about. That's where it was first mentioned. If you notice in that brief, it said it should be considered because it was mentioned in the earnest money contract. Well, it might be mentioned, but it was merged into the deed. So that part, you cannot use the property as consideration for a separately executed document when the consideration says $10. Now, there could have been other consideration given. But you cannot expand it because they failed to do one thing. They failed to put other good in value.
So we're at closing. We're sitting, the buyer and the seller are sitting across from one another, and the deed's on the table, and the options agreement is on the table. We sign them, but we sign the deed first.
Yes, ma'am.
30 seconds later, we sign the option. You say that option's in there.
Right. I say it's not enforceable unless.
What if we say, so if we sign the option agreement 30 seconds before the deed, then it would be enforceable.
It's got to be supported by consideration.
Well, and the unstated consideration, if we sign the option agreement first, would be, I'm not going to sign that deed until I see you sign the option agreement.
When you're in a closing, Your Honor, I don't know if you've ever attended one, but they just throw all kinds of documents to you. Right. I mean, then you know that they just hand you documents.
And I read everything I've...
Ma'am?
I read everything I saw.
Well, some people don't. I mean, your lawyers normally do. But some people, they just throw documents at you and you sign them. What's this? Oh, it's required. So we do it.
What does that have to do with consideration? That was the deal going in, that was supposed to be signed at closing. Under my hypothetical, they are both signed at closing. And does it make any difference whether one's signed ahead of the other or not?
No.
But
if you notice that the option is dated different than the deed, that's why they wanted them to be separate documents. Stated differently.
I was just saying, under my hypothetical, you're at closing. Does it matter which one signed first?
No.
It's unenforceable, period.
No, I'm saying it's unenforceable because it has to be supported by consideration. I'm saying all prior agreements are merged into that deed.
But we're executing them within 30 seconds of each other.
It doesn't matter. It has to be supported by consideration. Because, like I said, all prior agreements, all negotiations.
What if we sign the option before the deed?
Doesn't matter. The negotiations for it was in the earnest money contract, and all those negotiations are merged into the deed.
What if the earnest money contract said...
I beg your pardon?
What if the earnest money contract said, I'm not going to sell the land unless you execute the option?
Didn't say that.
The question was, what if...
It wouldn't matter because it's merged into the deed. Doesn't matter what you say. Doesn't matter what the negotiations are.
So what if the deed recites, I wouldn't have made that sale unless the option had been executed?
That would present a different question.
That's why I'm asking.
It might present a different question, but you may not be able to.
It is probative of whether or not these documents were executed as part of the same transaction with the same general purpose.
The intention of the parties, Your Honor, they intended them to be separate. Intentions of the parties. You know, it's the parties intended these to be two separate transactions because. There would have been no reason that they could not have put the option in the deed to preserve it, just like minerals, just like an easement. No difference. And so in this case, they wanted them to be separate and distinct. And because they had to be separate and distinct, each had to be supported by consideration. And you cannot go outside the four corners of the instrument the way the consideration clause is written. Chris, the consideration clause says $10. If it is that other good and valuable, it could have been a promise for me to wash his car, to be facetious. But it's not. The four corners says
$10, and that's why we're here.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Chris Brown will present the rebuttal.
Y'all put it in the summary judgment?
Your Honor, it was in the summary judgment. We cited McKay versus Talley out of the Amarillo Court in 1920 in a writ case. Estoppel was brought up. I begin with the merger doctrine, Your Honors. The earnest money contract was not merged into the deed for the purposes of the option agreement. I cite the court to a case that is not mentioned in our brief, but which has been provided to opposing counsel, Harris versus Roe, a Texas Supreme Court case in 1979, where this court said, a deed that constitutes partial performance of the preceding contract does not merge other distinct and unperformed provisions of the contract. A contract which provides for the performance of acts other than conveyance remains in full force and effect as to other such acts. That is exactly the situation that we have in this case. Addendum A to the earnest money contract specifically provided that there would be an option that survived closing that would allow the buyback of the property. And it is that mention in the earnest money contract that allows for this court to consider the purchase price of the property or the earnest money placed on the earnest money contract as additional consideration for the option agreement. So if this court decides not to follow the restatement or even take it a step further.
Let me just posit. The court wouldn't even have to get into it, would it? I mean, the court could just say, however, we'll leave that question for another day. Everyone seems to agree that even a gratuitous option is if you exercise it before revocation, is okay. So I think that opposing counsel's just conceded that. So if the option was properly exercised in this case, that answers the question even by your opposing counsel's submission.
It does, Your Honor, and to expand on a misstatement made, a closing did take place. Mr. Millis did go to the title company on the date mentioned in the letter and tendered the money to the title company. No one showed on the other side from Ms. Jopsch's camp, and therefore no closing took place. So even if this court does not hold that the notice itself was sufficient to exercise the option, which we believe it was, certainly the act of going to the title company and depositing the monies does get us there. So yes, there are several levels here. Another issue that I would like to bring up is something that the Court of Appeals relied upon, and that is the decision of Eccles versus Bloom. And they relied on that case for the proposition that consideration must pass in order for a contract to be valid. In that case, we were looking at an earnest money contract situation where there was an option for, I believe, 13 or 14 days in which the offer for purchase would remain open. Although the earnest money contract stated that the $500 earnest money had passed and was deposited with the title company, it in fact was not paid until the last day of the option, the 13th day. And the court in Eccles versus Bloom held that that money under the earnest money contract could not stand as consideration because it was not paid. But when you couple that with the Harris versus Roe decision from this court in 1979 that says the option does not merge, what you now have is there's no dispute that the earnest money was paid. The earnest money was paid well before the option period even began. And so even Eccles versus Bloom is distinguishable on the facts because the reason the option was nullified in Eccles is because the earnest money was never paid. So again, if this court does not feel comfortable adopting the restatement and going to that level, even the decisions of the law as it stands now support the fact that the earnest money contract, first of all, does not merge into the deed as far as the option is concerned. And the court has recognized in Eccles versus Bloom that that underlying earnest money that is paid certainly serves as additional consideration for the options.
Do you know whether it's commonplace to put option agreements like this in deeds?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar of them being placed in deeds themselves, but it is clear that and I believe it's the U.S. Life Title versus U.S. Life Title Company of Dallas versus Andron that again stated that when these contracts are executed together, even though they're not on the same day, they are construed as a single document, and therefore the option agreement in this case can be considered a part of the deed. They are considered together to explain and to show the full breadth of the transaction between the parties.
Your argument is premised on $1 or $10 being nominal consideration, but what if it was $1,000?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe, well, my position before this court today is the amount of the consideration is irrelevant.
Okay, so
whether
the brief seemed to me to talk a whole lot about nominal and peppercorn, and I was trying to get an idea of where you would draw the line, but if there's no line to be drawn.
For an option agreement, I would submit there's no line.
Okay.
Does the restatement support that position?
The restatement merely states, well, yes, Your Honor, it does support that position.
But there are examples that talk about a sliding scale for the amounts.
My understanding
might be enforceable.
My understanding of the amounts, Your Honor, go to the underlying fairness of the transaction, which is going to remain a consideration regardless of what we do with consideration. We're not asking this court to say now all contracts are fair. If one of the requirements for it to be an option agreement that can exist without consideration is that it is a fair transaction, that
a fair underlying transaction. You mean the underlying transaction?
The underlying transaction,
not the option transaction itself.
That's my position, Your Honor. Well, I believe we should go further than the statement and say that option agreements require not even a recital of consideration, which would take that issue basically out of the equation.
Or just that the recital creates an enforceable obligation.
Well, and Your Honor, that was the argument at the trial court level and at the court of appeals level, because of course we were dealing within the confines of the current state of Texas law. And although the court of appeals chose to distinguish McKay v. Talley and Hurd versus Pratt, I don't necessarily agree that the court got it right on the distinction. Both of those cases hold that the payment of consideration, the recital of consideration, creates an obligation to pay. Court of Appeals found additional consideration in both of those cases and relied upon that additional consideration for saying only when additional consideration is found is it not necessary to pay. And they cited the Eccles versus Bloom case for that proposition. I would submit that a closer reading of McKay v. Talley and Hurd v. Pratt indicates that the court made a very clear decision that the estoppel argument is valid.
Let's just say we wipe out this whole recital business and we don't require consideration. What does that do? Just assume for me that there are people out there that believed that the law required consideration and that it be paid. And the option contract is in front of them. They sign it knowing that there's no money exchanging hands, that they can walk away from that anytime they want. Wouldn't a holding like the one that you're proposing potentially prejudice those people's reliance on the prior law?
Your Honor, I would submit that it would not, because as Mr. Gilbert indicated, discussions with every businessman that we've come into contact with has stated that they don't take the money that is recited, and they do not believe that the failure to accept the money is going to invalidate the option. It's basically just a reverse of the current situation. And I think that adopting the restatement position will make Texas law much clearer, much fairer, and much more in line with the modern view, that in an option agreement, which is a part of another commercially relevant transaction, the issue of considerations is simply not an issue.
Counsel, is your description of what happened at the proposed closing in the record?
It is, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in the second cause. We'll take another brief recess.